And on the next day, the people who remained on the other side of the sea saw, I'll begin a little bit further down. And when they found him on the other side, they said to him, Rabbi, when did you come here? And Jesus answered to them, Truly, truly, I say to you, you seek me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Do not labor for the food which perisheth, but for the food which endures to eternal life, which the Son of Man will give to you, for on him has God the Father set his seal. Then they said to him, What must we do to do the work of God? And Jesus answered them, This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. And so they said to him, Then what sign do you do that we may see and believe? And what work do you perform? Our fathers ate the man in the wilderness, as it is written, He gave them bread from heaven to eat. And Jesus said to them, Truly, truly, I say to you, it was not Moses who gave you the bread from heaven. My Father gives you the true bread from heaven. For the bread of God is that which came down from heaven and which gives life to the world. And they said to him, Lord, give us this bread always. May we continue with the prayers of the suffragists. It isn't that I'm going to put so much more into the meditation that I'm taking off my coat. It's that I'm beginning to feel that the fulfillment has come true of having our evening devotions in the sauna. Feel of the warmth of the fire, but in a day and an evening like this, it certainly feels fine. I'd like to think with you for a few minutes tonight on the central subject of this scripture lesson that has been read from the Gospel of John, where Jesus says he is the bread of life. And especially to think upon this thought of the bread by which we live. Back in high school days, we had great delight in reading the poetry of Robert Service, the poet of the Klondike. And I remember in one of his poems, I think it was The Cremation of Sam McGee, he started with these words, There are strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. I'd like to paraphrase these words tonight under this thought. There are strange things done in the midnight of the soul in the men who wrestle with the desperation of hunger. The story is told by the survivor of the infamous Andersonville prison of Civil War days, where hunger stripped the men of all of their morals and even of their humanity. That there were two men that had been fighting side by side through the war. They'd become very close friends, and then they were taken prisoners. And now they lay side by side into the prison, and they were gradually growing weaker for the want of food. The effects of the hunger was becoming evident in each of them. And each was patiently waiting for the other to die so that he might have the handful of beans and the portion of bread that the other individual consumed. Then one day, the one with the greatest strength became very impatient. And in his desperation, he choked his companion to death, only because of the fact that he had overexerted him to die just a few moments later. Now I mention this tonight because if we can see that a person can do something like this when he is starving physically, emaciated and helpless because of hunger. Certainly, how much more true is it not when the soul within us is dying, but still the individual has the strength of a strong physique to execute the devilish acts that arise within the realms of that soul. Now, I'm afraid that we're treading in an area here that we can't understand. And even here at Holden Village, I presume there's hardly any of us here this evening outside of the Hinderleys who were in the Bagua prison during the war that really know what hunger means. And I presume that this is one of the reasons why that we are having great difficulty in understanding the time and the age in which we live. Ex-President Eisenhower, now has passed away, once pointed out in one of his addresses as he was discussing international relations, he emphasized the fact that one half of the world lives in hunger. And then he brought out this fact, that food and the satisfaction of hungering people is certainly of far greater importance than any political ideas. And then further on, he brought out this very interesting thought, that the degree of our sacrifice in feeding a hungry world is the degree of our understanding of the world in which we live today. And yet I dare say this is only half of the story. This is true with regard to the physical hunger of that prevailed. How much more true is it not, both individually and collectively, of the fearful desperations of the spiritually emaciated and anemic souls as people are trying to live without true spiritual sustenance today? Have you ever asked yourself the question just why it is that even in spite of the fact that so many religions do not satisfy still the zeal of the religious practices? We've had the privilege of knowing some Jewish families. Christ is not included, we know. And yet sometimes I've looked with envy upon their zeal, their religious zeal, and their sincerity. I've often thought of the Orientals that gather around the statues of their Buddhas, or around the writings of the Confucius, of how at times they torture and mutilate their God-given bodies because of their religious practice. And I presume there is a reason why that the Arab and sitting around the bonfire on the safaris out in the desert, shoulder to shoulder after their physical appetites are satisfied, as I've heard them tell, begin gradually to sway, to gather, chanting Allah, Allah. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his only prophet. And I presume that we can see it in our own midst, where people try to live without God. But in situations of desperation, or in their love for their young ones, their children, they seek the spiritual sustenance. Because the soul of man is living, the soul of man is real, It must be nourished and sustained. And without that sustenance, certainly, it becomes the victim together with the pangs of starvation. And it cries aloud in its distress and in its complexities. And it seeks whatever course that it can find in order to satisfy its wants. And yet we are oftentimes blind to these situations. I suppose one of the glorious times of the Old Testament was when Isaiah lived, and yet, even though he was a part of the chosen people, it was a desperate situation. It's tragic to read with regard to the descriptions that he gives. A sinful nation, that people laden with iniquity, the offspring of evildoers, sons that deal corruptly, people that have forsaken the Lord and despised the Holy One of Israel. The whole heart is sick and the whole heart faint, and from the sole of the foot even to the head there is no soundness in it. The ox knows its owner and the ass its master's crib, but my people does not know, and my people does not understand. And the interesting part of it is that he ascribes this entire, not only religious, but national situation of his people to one thing, and that is that his people have been cut off from God and from the spiritual sustenance that they need therefrom. And so it is that he makes this beautiful appeal as their only hope. O everyone that thirst, come to the waters, and he who has no money can buy and eat without money and without price. Why do you spend money for that which is not bread, and your labors for that which satisfieth not? Hearken to me and eat that which is good, and delight yourself in the fatness. Incline your ears and come to me and hear, and your soul shall live. And then follows one of the most classic expressions of hope that I presume that we can find in all of history. And perhaps at some time or another you've had the privilege of either hearing the recording or in person Marian Anderson's beautiful rendition of this thought. Thus he will feed his flock. And then behold, the Lord Jehovah will come as the mighty one. He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs in his arms. He will carry them in his bosom and will gently lead those that have their young. Some years ago, a well-known Norwegian writer, Johan Boyer, wrote a book, and he entitled it The Great Hunger. I have a sneaky notion that he drew greatly from his own life. He was born in poverty. As a young man, spent his nights and his days, many of them, in the hard and the perilous fisheries of Lofoten Island. We went through that region just over a year ago, and I couldn't help but think of some of the descriptions that he made, and the truth that is oftentimes said that as you go into the cemeteries of these towns, that you will find mostly on the tombstones the names of the women, the children who have died, because the men were lost at sea. But Johan Boyer made something of himself. He became quite well educated, and he wrote this book, and the chief character of the book was Per Holm. Per Holm was also born and raised in poverty, but through the hunger of his soul for education and enlightenment, he became an engineer. He left his country. He went down into the areas of Abyssinia and of Africa. And he made not only a name for himself, but he also made a fortune. And then he returned home. He was going to live the rest of his days with his family in ease and in luxury in the land that in which he was born and where he had learned to love. But it didn't turn out that way. He didn't find the peace that he sought. Through the depression, he didn't find luxury. He lost practically everything that he had. He became the village blacksmith, and then he became virtually blind. Two of his children had to be taken away from Paramount and given to an aunt. And the third was killed by his neighbor's mad wolf dog. And one day in this situation, he stood by his anvil, and he seemed to hear from the distance the voice that was speaking to him, "Stand erect, my soul." And there, Pear found his God. A few nights later, as a result of his spiritual experience, he gathered together the small amount of barley that he had stored up, and he went out into the field of his neighbor whose dog had killed his child and whose barley crop had been destroyed by the early frost, and he reseeded it. And he explains that it was an experiment that he wanted to try in forgiveness. And of this experiment, he writes, "I began to feel an unspeakable compassion for all men upon earth. I knew that what I hungered for in my best years was neither knowledge nor honor nor riches, but to build a temple where we may lift our souls in anthem as a gift to heaven." In the light of this, we need to ask ourselves the question, what is the bread by which we live? I'm sure that here at Holden Village, it is quite easy to answer that question. And I would say this, if I analyze this group correctly, that in the background of your lives, we would find an easy answer to it. But I wonder, as we look out upon our society as a whole, and that which we are subject to from day to day, where'er we may be, the hillbilly culture, for instance, of the most of the television screen, the marriage standards of the country club crowd and of Hollywood, the modern writings with its dirt, with its filth, the barbaric jazz of the jungle rhythm, the deep satisfactions of hate and of revenge, the selling of our souls, according to our present ideals, for the material gain, because this seems to be the standard of success that we have set up before us. Now, as I've said, perhaps you and I may not take these too seriously, and yet we must admit, perhaps even on greater authorities than our own, that these constant more or less the general moral and the spiritual sustenance of our age. And in the light of this, it is very easy to understand those discrepancies of our modern culture that we otherwise cannot find. For the food of Christ is different. It is the food of love, of forgiveness, of the virtues by which we live, the wisdom and the power by which we come to the true success, the fulfillment of our hopes. I'd like to close with another illustration taken from the famed French revolutionist. Thomas Carlyle tells the story. It was that of the French minister in the time of this revolution by the name of Foulon. He had charged, was largely responsible for the oppressing financial schemes. And in the light of this, and particularly the financial pressure that was put upon the people, some of his advisors asked him the question, if you do this and continue, what will the people do? Now let's remember that this was in a time when the people were crying for freedom and relief from oppression, from famine and pestilence and crime, and the battle cry was the liberty, equality, and fraternity. And to this question of his advisors, the ministers replied, the people may eat grass. The revolt rose. The people seized the officials, including Foulon, and they hanged this minister to a post. And after he was dead, the people stuffed his mouth with grass. It does make a difference as to what we feed upon. And well may we ask ourselves the question, as the waiter upon whom all eyes do wait, come before us and places the menu of life before us, what do you have? May we continue as we join in a hymn that brings out this same thought, number 519.